Welcome back to Finding the Edge podcast. I'm Garrett Boyum, joined with Robert Fry.
And today we have on, again, Caleb Abney. And man, this was just such a great conversation. Always a delight to have Caleb on. He really brings a very, very unique perspective and a very against the grain perspective that we really enjoy talking with. That's not in a very sense that not against the grain in a bad way, but against the grain in terms of really kind of makes
challenging.
You think.
He's very challenging to the baseball community, and so I wanted to bring him on because he had another very interactive Twitter post that had a lot of conversation going, and that I had jumped in on that conversation. And one of the things that I think, you know, as passionate as Caleb is, he's also able to have a very civil conversation. And so I wanted to give a little bit more of a nuanced conversation, although we didn't touch on all the things that were said on Twitter. We still had a good conversation and kind of fleshed out a little bit more of his ideas and kind of my thoughts surrounding that. So we hope you guys enjoy this talk with Caleb. I'm sure we'll have more of him on. So we're going to do something new. This is very new. Zencastr now lets us record our faces, and it puts a little logo in the corner. So now you know what app or software or website we're using. And two, by the way, I highly recommend Zencastr. I love it because if my internet's bad or Robert's internet's bad, it doesn't matter because it still captures what we're saying. So we can give you the best, highest quality product experience. This isn't a product because I'm not selling anything. So maybe Zencastr, but I don't make any. They're not giving me any credits or any money for this. I'm paying them. So, you know, anyways. I like Zencastr if you're thinking about podcasting and doing stuff like this. I like Zencastr. Drawback, though, they do not have a share screen function yet. So if that's something you're looking for, they don't have it. But as far as making sure you got your audio and you got your video, they got you for that. So anyways, this is going to be a new thing. Hopefully we do this more often. Robert's got a great setup. My setup is slowly coming along. Maybe I'll have something on this back wall at some point. But we're excited to do video. So be looking out for that. If you're listening, this will be up on our YouTube channel. We have a YouTube channel, Finding the Edge. Check it out up on YouTube. So, yeah.
I guarantee it'll be a fun time.
Absolutely. Dude,
time of your life. Whoever listens or watches, best time of your life.
And so just so you guys know, on our YouTube page, we have the analytics roundtable that we did. And that's not on the podcast in any of the episodes. I'm pretty sure we didn't do that because I think that was such a in-person experience that I didn't want to make it a podcast because there'd be too much dead space and I didn't want to edit it. So,
And the beauty of it is in that roundtable, of all the guest speakers that we had, the main three guest speakers that we had, two of them currently work in MLB front offices, and the other one is a full-time driveline employee. So think about that. There's a lot of knowledge to be passed around there.
There's some good conversation. I think we recorded some of it right on a piece of technology that they didn't really think that much of that we both use now.
Correct. We're not going to give away that piece of technology because we want you to watch it.
Yeah. We got to get that view count up.
That's right.
Make sure to watch it on Brave or have an ad block so you don't see any ads. I don't know if there's any ads on it because I have ad block on my web browser. I don't make any money from it. So therefore, don't give YouTube any money. I don't know. But anyways, and two, if you guys like this content, make sure to drop a comment, add us on Twitter or, you know, because this will be on YouTube, throw comments in there. And I'm sure because, you know, it's the internet, we'll get all sorts of fun comments. So please share your fun comments below. So I hope you enjoy this episode with Caleb Abney. Let's begin. But it's been a while since we've had you on, Caleb. So I want to say we should do the catch-up thing, but we kind of did that here. And
yeah,
maybe just dive right in. I don't know. Unless, Robert, you got any other way you want to take it?
No, we're going to dive right in.
All right, let's do it.
Dive right in.
I mean, talk about our favorite subject, which is hitting.
Yeah.
But yeah, so... Caleb, you had a tweet that had quite a bit of engagement on Twitter here recently. So, do you mind telling us about like that one with Bryce Harper? Where do you find all your clips, by the way?
Actually, this one was, and I actually don't even know who it is that's hitting there. If I'm being honest, it's one of the Phillies hitters, but Bryce Harper is standing off to the side of the cage. He's about to go in there to hit.
Oh yeah, he is.
But
that's right.
Yeah, I still haven't been able to figure out who that is hitting, the left-handed hitter, the left-handed hitter who's actually hitting. But anyway, actually didn't find this clip. I literally went old school on this. I had MLB Network on in the afternoon and looked up on the TV, and they had their ballpark cam on. And they were showing the Phillies batting practice from the afternoon of that game. And I guess this was it was Thursday or Friday. I can't remember what day. And I saw that they were hitting off of a machine. And it was a challenging velocity. And the guy who was in there, I mean, they had the camera on there for several seconds. So there were probably six or seven different swings that were picked up, and I don't think a single one of them was like barreled to the middle of the field. He had fouled a couple off, and several of them he was extremely late on, didn't look comfortable. And I scrambled very quickly to grab my phone and to go and start recording it. So that's literally just a recording of my TV on my phone. And then I just kind of edited the clip. And then just put the little comments that I put on there. So that was kind of how that all came about. It was a very organic kind of in the moment. I saw it and I was like, oh, that could be useful for people to think about, or could be something that is going to get a lot of people very angry, which I think it did in some ways. Yeah, that was kind of how it all came about.
So I guess... first thing I think got people kind of wanting to engage with it was, you know, I guess the question is how much success does an athlete need beforehand, you know, to feel like they can perform in game? You know, is it all just mental, or is there a level of you have to be able to demonstrate proficiency in practice to actually be able to perform in the game?
So I think that's the age-old question, right? Well, let me back up. I don't know that that's the age-old question. I don't know that that question has been asked up until the last 5-10 years or so, and that may even be on the high side, because previously, like, it wasn't even a debate. Like, you know, you want to feel good going into the game, and your success during practice is an indication of your potential for success during the game. And it's very much a conventional, traditional, like well baked in sort of idea in our community in baseball. And I think the last five years or so, people have started to kind of ask that question. Well, is that really what leads to success? How much success we see in a a dumbed down, if you will, practice environment just to make ourselves feel like we're better prepared for the game because we, you know, quote, see success before the game and we, quote, build confidence and we're feeling good. Those are things that we have come to value in our game for a long, long time. And I think the last few years, people have finally started asking the question, like, you know, maybe there's a way to do it a little bit better or at least differently that could lead to more success if we are okay with challenging the entire perceptual motor system before the game so that then maybe the system feels like it's able to solve problems, which that was another thing that I got into a couple days ago, the whole problem solving thing and, you know, kind of having an issue with that. But is the perceptual motor system able to be more attuned to the task when they get into a game if they've seen something challenging before they get into the game? So I think that's a good question to ask. And I'm not going to pretend like I have the answer to that. I have my opinions on that. Others have their opinions on that. But I think it's a good question to ask. And it's good that we are starting to go down this road where we're exploring that and trying to find better solutions to how we go about preparing guys before they step into the box against 97 miles an hour with sink and cut and nasty breaking balls. How we prepare and how we think about what being prepared means, I think that's an important piece of it too. How do we define what preparation is? I think those are good questions to ask that, you know, we have just started to explore the last few years, and I think moving forward we'll, you know, hopefully come up with better answers to that.
I think though too, one of the things that isn't talked about in when you post stuff like this is that you really have to set this up for players. You don't just throw them into it. You know, they just don't show up at the ballpark and be like, all right, here's what we're doing today. That's not a recipe for success. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'm sure you've seen it. Players aren't going to take well to all of a sudden just being challenged one day. Like, I think it's really important to let them know about it, build it up, and help players really understand why we're doing this. And then get them to really work on getting them to buy in to having challenging practice environments and the importance of that.
Yeah.
And I think because that's not the norm, you know, that might actually be a slower process than, you know, what it comes off on Twitter. You know, like you might have to kind of do a blend and slowly drip it in and over time mm-hmm. get it to that place of where we're doing a lot more challenging stuff and guys actually really want and desire that stuff because they know and they understand that that's going to help them be a much better player come game time.
Yeah. And I think you hit the nail on the head there. And I can tell you from personal experience and having, you know, from having to learn that exact lesson and still continuing to try to learn that exact lesson that you just mentioned, Garrett, in helping players understand the reasoning, helping them understand the why behind something before you make their lives miserable from their perspective. And maybe helping them understand that, okay, maybe if you adjust how you view this and you adjust your thinking, maybe you're not going to be quite as miserable, but that takes conversation and that takes building a relationship. It takes building trust, which there have been times and areas that I've done a better job of that than others. And there are times and areas that all of us as coaches, you know, can look back and evaluate and say, okay, we could have done a lot better job here, or we need to do a better job with this. But yeah, that sort of slow transition, especially when it's such a part of the DNA of how we have gone about preparation in baseball for so long, just coming in and, you know, wrecking everything, just being a massive wrecking ball and making all these massive changes overnight without explanation and without that relationship, without that give and take, is not a recipe for success. So I think those are definitely things from a psychological standpoint that we need to take into account. The emotions that kind of go along with that is a constraint in itself. and helping guys be able to deal with those emotions and sort of manage that is such a big piece to helping guys, as you said, want to do those types of things that, you know, ultimately we feel like there is some research and there's some science to show that could have a greater benefit for them, and help them to be successful. But if they don't buy into that from a success standpoint and that it's going to transfer come game time, then it doesn't really matter what we think if they're not in the right psychological and emotional state in order to be able to accept it and then, you know, find success from that. So that's a big piece. I agree with you on that.
Yeah. And kind of to bounce off both Caleb and Garrett's points is, yeah, like you both said, like there has to be buy-in. You can simply cannot just overnight be like, hey, here we go, we're going to start doing machines for BP. Like, there has to be some sort of setting. I know in my personal experience, the setting is like a classroom setting, something to kind of like, hey, we're introducing this concept. It's not going to come right away, but, and then here's why. And then be able to get players' feedback, because maybe there's something that when we're instituting kind of these concepts, a player's feedback could be valuable in this scenario where we get, you know, player X's feedback and we're like, hey, we actually didn't think about that before. Okay, let's incorporate that as well.
You know, too, I think one of the things that my colleagues, Tyler and Sean, talk a lot about is including the player in the practice session in terms of what you're about to do. And I think one good question to ask players is, how can you make this more representative? Or what's a way that you could make what we're doing right now more game-like? And kind of include them and start getting them to think along those lines. And especially when they suggest it, I feel like then they're going to have more buy-in if they're the ones that's suggesting it.
Yeah.
So I think that's a good way to try to introduce that more into, say, for example, if guys are really wanting traditional BP or flips or something like that, just simply asking them, hey, what is one way that you guys think that we could make this more game-like?
Yeah. Yeah. It, as far as getting players to have some level of ownership in the tasks that they're doing, is obviously going to help from a buy-in standpoint and help them get to the place where they're like, okay, I actually have some level of control over this. You know, I asked for this or I suggested this. So it's a little bit hard for me to then, you know, be complaining when, you know, I'm not having the level of success that I have, or the level of success that I want or expect in order for me to be successful in the game. I helped design this. So I think having them be a part of that design process can be a huge benefit to creating practice activities that both are going to create the transfer that we want and allow players to embrace them enough to where they're going to get something out of it.
Go ahead.
To kind of bounce off that, at the end of the day, like, the players are the ones that have the most recent experience of, like, being in a game-like situation. Sure, some of us coaches have had playing experience. Some of us coaches may have not had playing experience. But at the end of the day, like, they're, in terms of that kind of recency effect, the players should still have some weight on, you know, what's best to replicate a game-like environment, because they're the ones that have been in that game-like environment most recently compared to the coaching staff most times.
Sure. One thing on the other side of that I will say, not to be the curmudgeon coach that, you know, is assuming he has all the answers and players just have to do everything that I say, because there are those coaches that are out there. Most of the time, though, interestingly enough, those end up being the more traditional type coaches in how they go about their coaching ideas. But a point that I think can't get lost in the other direction on that is, if you have players that their concerns that they're bringing you are attached to their ego, that are attached to their frustrations because they look bad, because they don't feel good about themselves, because whatever reasons that they want to give that they are attaching their value to when they have the ability to show themselves and show others that they can be good or they can be successful. Or if they are blaming the task rather than looking internally to say, okay, what can I actually do to improve here? Is there something that I can change about my attitude or how I choose to approach this that is going to allow me to at least, even if I'm not finding success, at least get something out of it from, you know, a mental toughness standpoint, even at the very least. So I think having conversations with players and determining whether, okay, are you just asking this to be easier because you want it to be easier so that you feel better about yourself and because you don't want to have to do hard things? Or are you asking for this to change because ultimately you're somebody who's very tough in being able to do hard things, but you just don't see how this is really helping you come game time? I think those are two very different ideas to consider, whether we want players to, you know, to just be saying, oh, this is really hard, I don't want this to be as hard on me, or this is something that we can improve it in XYZ manner in order for me to actually get something more out of it. I think those are two separate things that, again, that conversation helps us arrive at a conclusion on which of those that it is. But the idea of pandering or coddling to players just because they don't like doing hard things, I'm also pretty passionate about helping players understand how that's not really a good perspective, not just in baseball, but in life in general, to make things harder just when it gets hard. So I think that's another piece to the puzzle that we can't just completely throw out and say, well, you know, the player's feedback should matter. Well, if the player's feedback is coming from a place of him being extremely soft, then maybe that's a conversation that we need to have about helping him, you know, sort of toughen up his perspective, not just in baseball, but from life standpoint as well.
Well, I think this is a good segue into part of the other conversation that went on in response to your tweet, in terms of like, okay, what do we do when it becomes too challenging, or do we, you know, how often do we want to do these really challenging things? And I think, at least for me, one of the things that I talked about and chimed in on was how to understand where the player is at and where their challenge point is at. And if they're getting overmatched right now, you may need to scale back what you're doing. And the way that I look at it from an ecological perspective is you want to scale the information. You start scaling the informational constraints, or basically the informational constraints, such that then it becomes a little bit more manageable for the athlete to be able to find success, to be able to actually coordinate their movements in a way that they do have some level of success. Like, to me, and this is kind of, you know, the genesis of this podcast, is we're looking to find that edge of where it's challenging enough where they're having to push beyond their current capabilities, but not so challenging that they have no grip on what's going on. And so, you know, I think even with like the machine, I can't remember who I was having this conversation with, but let's say you're challenging guys with high velo stuff and they're just absolutely having zero success. What you can do is start to scale it back in terms of dial the speed back a little bit to where they're having success, a little bit more success, and then, you know, slowly over time dialing it up. I think even too, Caleb, did we have this conversation? I can't remember, of like, you know, you started a little bit slower where they're kind of more comfortable, and then just over time you just slowly turn it up.
Yeah.
And I think that's one way to get guys to buy in a little bit more and to also challenge them with high velo, but then also for them to have success. But if you think about it too, from the standpoint of guys need to kind of get calibrated early on, having it dialed down a little bit is going to allow them to calibrate to the machine. And then as you slowly step it up, that's a much smoother transition. And so that is a simple example of information scaling, is, you know, just changing up the speed at which the machine's at. But you know how I feel about machines. That's a separate tangent that we can get on here a little bit.
Well, I would say to that point, I agree wholeheartedly from a information scaling standpoint, and, you know, dialing it back just to allow guys to see success or find success or calibrate, so that then you can kind of slowly start ramping up the speed without them realizing it. And then all of a sudden they slowly calibrate up to a faster speed than maybe they would have been able to if they started from the very beginning. And I definitely have done that and definitely will continue to do that. I guess, and, you know, pretty consistent with my questioning contrarian type of perspective on a lot of things, the flip side of that, again, that I will suggest is, what is our objective? Ultimately, the question is, what are we trying to do as coaches? What are we helping to, what adaptation are we seeking? And is it just for them to be able to adapt to and then find success in that task that we're asking them to do? Then yes, that is obviously, you know, a very good strategy to employ in order to achieve that goal. But if the goal is to challenge their entire cognitive system, starting from a cognition standpoint, working all the way to, you know, how our actions actually play out in real time, if we're trying to challenge that emotionally, psychologically, mentally, then if that's something that we're trying to do, if that is the objective as coaches, should we be seeking them to find a ton of success, or really much success at all? So I think those are two separate questions, and I would suggest that there is a place at times, even if it's just from an emotional standpoint, or replicating the level of success or the level of stress when you get into a game against a pitcher that feels like it's impossible to hit. At times we need to replicate that type of stress in practice as well. And, you know, you might face a team that has, you know, three really good starting pitchers, and it feels like in a weekend series, it feels like you're up against a wall, all three series where these guys are unhittable. Well, if we maybe did the types of things in practices and put our hitters in situations where it feels unhittable to them, are they then going to be able to be more successful from, you know, a psychological standpoint, and that level of toughness that they're going to need in that moment to be able to overcome a really challenging task, like facing a pitcher who throws really hard with really nasty stuff, and it feels like you can't find success ever. Is that something that we can replicate that in practice that then prepares them for that level of stress come game time? If the goal at all times is just to find success in practice, which, you know, you guys probably know this about me, I tend to be on the other side of things. I tend to want to do very little of activities that actually provide a ton of success for this very reason. I think the level of stress that we feel in practice a lot of times should replicate the level of stress that we feel in games, so that then we're better prepared once we actually get there. So I think it's two separate questions, and I think it's two separate objectives that you're trying to achieve from a practice design standpoint. And I'm not saying that there isn't a place for both. I just think the secondary one that I'm a big believer in is something that a lot of coaches miss out on, because they want players to see that success, or they want to see players have that success. And we kind of get caught up in that, and I think we miss an entirely different undertrained element of the game.
Well, I wonder how much of the reason why coaches feel the need to see that success with their players in practice is that's how they gauge whether or not their stuff is working.
Yeah.
And I think that's the one of the hard parts. You know, it's like, how do we measure this? Especially because the game right now is all about, collecting data and being data driven. Mm-hmm. And so I guess the question that I have, and maybe Robert might want to chime in on this, is like, how do we measure this, and how do we, you know, especially in a game, especially where the game is at today, being so data driven, you know, is this a measurable thing, or like, you know, how do we go about integrating these two things?
Yeah, I think there's a way to be able to quantify it. I can't give you an exact answer, but the idea is that you can, in some way, shape, form, kind of compare, say, like, let's say, you know, you're going into a weekend series, like Caleb mentioned, you're going against three really good starters. You understand kind of what their pitch types are and how they're doing things. You can then, for that week of practice, for hitting, et cetera, you can then, you know, dial the machines or BP, whatever, to kind of replicate that as close as possible, and then be able to see results in game. And then let's say the next week, you know, you're going up against three soft tossers, in this case, just for a basic example, and then just make everything slower, and then go from there in a way that you can then see results from practice into game-like results. It's an inexact science in that case, but at the very least, you could still be able to quantify that, saying, okay, hey, we're doing this, you know, and then be able to make tweaks in the future if, you know, you were to face that team again, or, you know, you're doing multiple series against that team, so you know who the three starters are for that weekend. Some teams, some conferences will do that. You face a certain team multiple times in the season. But moral of the story is there is a way to do it, and kind of just, it's more or less like, not like a way of collecting data in terms of progression. There is some form of progression, but it's more of like a checks and balances.
Caleb, you got anything to add on that?
Yeah, so that is definitely something that I have implemented those types of ideas in the past. I mean, at smaller schools that don't have much tech available and can't, you know exact velocities. And obviously at the big league level, they can replicate the spin rate and exactly how the fastball moves and, you know, vertical movement, horizontal movement, all that kind of stuff, breaking balls. But to try to replicate those types of things at smaller schools that don't have those types of resources, it's exactly like Robert said. It's, you know, when you face a pitching staff that, you know, okay, we know we're facing a pitching staff that guys throw really hard. Okay, we're going to crank the machines up this week so that we're trying to speed up guys' eyes, as much as we possibly can, so that, you know, hopefully the fastball looks slower once we get to game time. If we're facing, you know, a soft lefty, then, you know, we're going to set the fastball up a little bit slower. We're going to move it to the other side of the mound to kind of replicate that angle, mix in some like softer breaking balls, just so guys work on the types of things that they're going to actually be seeing come game time that weekend. I do agree that it is an inexact science, because ultimately perception is an inexact science. And cognition is absolutely about as far away from an exact science as we can measure right now. So when you take those two things into account, which are such big pieces to the problem solving puzzle, and being able to solve pitch problems, in game for hitters, you know, we want so much to cling to objective numbers, and we want so much to cling to these objective, okay, we know this is fact, this is data, which is why we focus so much on the action, right? That's why so many hitting coaches focus on action. They focus on the movement, they focus on the swing, because we can measure that. We have all kinds of different things now that we can measure that. We can't measure perception. I mean, there are small pieces of progress that we have gained, you know, as far as eye gaze tracking and things like that. But that still doesn't tell the whole piece of it. It still comes very, very short in telling the entire story, because ultimately all that stuff happens where? In our brains, which is very difficult for us to measure, you know, the brain activity that actually leads to our eyes moving in that certain way. We can't measure thoughts. We can't measure emotions. We can ask questions, but even that data is unreliable because we don't know if we're getting the whole story from the athletes that we're asking these questions to. So those, all these types of things that go into the entire system are things that it's difficult for us to track. It's difficult for us to measure. So we tend to shy away from it. So we focus on the things that we can. I'm not saying that we shouldn't focus on the things that we can measure and come as close as we possibly can in those ways. But I think forgetting about the rest of it and not having an understanding of the psychological piece, the emotional piece, the cognition, the thoughts, the previous history, all these things that go into the context, I think we're missing a lot if we focus so much on the things we can measure that we try to pretend like those things are just a given or that they should just be there. And I think that's where we're missing a lot right now from a development standpoint and even an in-game strategy standpoint with how we're trying to help hitters be successful.
Yeah, I would agree with a lot of that. And two, though, I do think, you know, you can definitely measure some of those things in terms of, you know, cognitions. I do feel like we probably have to define that for people, at least for me. And I know Caleb and I have had this conversation before. When we're talking about cognitions, we're not talking about like a ton of thoughts. Like to me, I am thinking much more about like what's the cognitive state of the athlete, more so than, you know, the processing thoughts that are going on. Because to me, it's all about how they're connecting with the information in the environment. And if you have lots of thoughts going on in your brain, like you're not actually fully present and able to pick up and connect with the information in the environment. And so when it comes to cognitions, it's very much like what's the mental state of the athlete and maybe what is their intention? And that's more what we are referring to. I don't want to put words in your mouth, Caleb, but that's that when you're saying cognitions, that's what I'm thinking about. And I know too, like one of the things that often comes up when people are talking about ecological dynamics is that cognition doesn't have a role. You know, but oftentimes people don't really explain what they mean when they do say that cognition does have a role in ecological dynamics. But it definitely does play a role. And that's, for me, how I view it is I'm very much looking at the overall state, the mental state or the psychological state of the athlete, more so than individual thoughts or, you know, all the complex thinking that I was thinking while you were talking there, you know, that was not helping me be present, right, fully present in what you were saying, you know. And that's what I want to communicate to the athletes is I want you to be fully present, being able to connect with the information in the environment and in the task. And so anyways, to transition back to measuring though, you can ask questionnaires, but one of the other big concepts that my colleagues talk a lot about in ecological dynamics, there's the difference between knowledge about something and knowledge of something. And when we ask something like a questionnaire, like you mentioned, Caleb, you're only capturing a little bit of what they actually experienced. And you're missing a whole bunch of other information that they weren't, they might not have been attending to because they were so focused on the task and achieving the task. Because there's a lot of things that happen subconsciously, and that's the way it should be. And the athlete's not going to be able to pick up on those things. And and so also too, there's the limitations of human language and all that sort of stuff. But I do think you can measure some of these things subjectively through questionnaires that can give you data points to kind of help and give you an idea of where they're at. And I think that can be useful, but we also have to remember that then we're also asking more of the athlete. And the athlete has to understand why they're doing it and how it can be helpful for them. And one of the ways that I think you can, if you want to do this, help athletes understand that this is important is it's a way for them to reflect. Because I do think like reflecting on what you're doing and having an idea of knowing well, why things are going well or why things aren't going well and what you can do to adjust that. You do need to have a period of reflection and being able to record what you've been doing to be able to help you then better reflect and make changes for the future.
Yeah. The extra piece that I would, I agree wholeheartedly from a standpoint of allowing athletes to have a level of introspection to be able to evaluate their own performances or evaluate their thoughts or their actions or their feelings or their intentions. The extra piece that I would add to that as it pertains to cognition is the historical context, which I think I tend to be a little bit more, I tend to provide a little more value to that than I think you do. And probably,
what do you mean by historical context?
Historical context, meaning, you know, what has happened previously, what is actually going into, you know, Garrett, you mentioned like being in the moment and what are my thoughts and my intentions in this exact moment? Well, there's a history that goes into like what leads to you having those thoughts or those lack of thoughts or those intentions or how you want to direct your cognition or how you want to direct your perceptions. There's a history that can lead to that. An easy example in my mind of that is a previous AB. You know, okay, so my first at bat, the pitcher comes up and throws me, you know, he throws me all fastballs, and I end up, after four or five pitches, I end up hitting a home run on it. Well, next time, he's probably not going to pitch me the same way, right? So me going into that at bat, me changing my approach to maybe saying, okay, I'm probably going to see a lot more breaking balls during this at bat than what he did last time because they figured out that he can't beat me with a fastball. That's going to change what my game plan is, right? And that's going to change what my approach is going into this at bat. And those are obviously good things for hitters to do. They all should be doing those things. To me, that is a piece. That is a piece of the puzzle to the cognition part of it. And those are things that, you know, we should be having conversations about those things, and those types of things can be built into questionnaires. They you know, they can be built into conversations either before the at bat, after the at bat, before the game, after the game. You talk about those things preseason, postseason. Those conversations can be had, but the fact that it's hard to measure those responses because those types of thoughts and that level of cognition is going to be different from athlete to athlete. So having something hard and fast that we can then measure just based on a questionnaire or a conversation, that's where the art of it comes in. And I think that's really kind of the heart of where I like to go with a lot of this is finding the art in a game that we're trying to make so scientific, and we are trying to create so many data points, and we forget about the part of the game that we can't create data points for yet. Maybe somewhere down the road we will be able to, but at this point in time, there's a lot of art, and to me, cognition and perception, those are arts right now. Maybe there will be a time when we're able to measure them better, and we're doing the best that we can. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't try to measure them and still continue to try to create as much progress in those areas as we can. But acknowledging where we are right now and to kind of wade through the muck of that, while trying to define things as best as we possibly can, is, you know, sort of a wave of development that I think is yet to come.
And I think too, we have to remember that, I don't know, to me, I don't want this to become like wholly scientific to the point that it becomes mechanistic. Mm-hmm. Like we can predict every outcome. Like what's the fun in that? Like, I think we have to remember, like, one of the things that makes athletics amazing and awesome is the human element, the parts that you can't predict. And there's a level of art, and like this goes back to one of the things that I've been very much getting into is this idea from Bruce Lee of human expression, right? Like if if it's about human expression, then all of a sudden the game becomes more about art. And when you think about it, at the end of the day, like, that's what it is, because it's entertainment. Like, nobody goes and sees entertainment where it's completely mechanistic and like, the outcome is already known. And, you know, there's no fun in that when it becomes all very rigid and mechanistic. And so, that I think is the fun of it, is that, especially too, though, is with baseball, you have the culmination or the intersection of science, mathematics, and the art. And I think that's where it becomes really, really cool. So to kind of jump back though, you know, when you're talking about history and experience, I do think that's an important piece that you brought up. But I also think that one of the other misconceptions that people have about, you know, your posts, and even the ecological approach, is that that is the main thing that's driving everything, is the player's past history. And all we're doing is throwing an athlete into an environment and just being like, all right, here you go, figure it out. And that's where I definitely think that people don't understand that there's still a role for the coach to help guide the athlete. And especially because when you're talking about history, like, we attend to the most recent thing that's happened. And so, you know, as a coach, that's where our role can come in, is we can redirect an athlete and redirect their attention to something else, help them to find more relevant information to help them be successful with what they're currently trying to do. And so that's one thing that I think I would really like coaches to understand, is neither one of us is advocating just throw the athlete in there into this environment, and not give them any structure, not give them any help, and just tell them to go figure it out.
Yeah, that's a very good point to bring up. And I think that is, you know, one of the main knocks and one of the main complaints that I get about a lot of my perspective on things. And I think the reason that it comes across that way is because, and maybe this is something that I can do a better job of, I think I err on going the opposite direction from what I perceive. And I don't think I'm the only one that sees this. I'm just one of the only ones that will actually bring it up and point it out, and will be unabashed with how I will be critical of this. The idea that we have created in our current baseball development climate, particularly on social media — I don't think it's just on social media, but especially on social media, which, you know, has all of its pitfalls for many different reasons that go outside of baseball, which is a whole nother podcast. We've created this climate where the coach knows everything, and the coach has all the answers, and the coach knows how the swing needs to look, and the coach knows how the swing needs to feel, and the coach — and it actually might make it worse, all the data, which I'm not anti-data by any stretch. I love data. I love things that are, you know, evidence-based and like hard research-based, and things that we can quantify. It's great if it's used in the right way. But I think that makes coaches worse, who tend to be that way already. They're like, see, I'm right. Look at this, and this. And it's all about the coach having his way, and it's about the coach looking good, and the coach building his brand, and the coach getting credit for this athlete doing this, and for turning this around. And the promotion of this, of these concepts, take precedence over the athletes. And I think that that's the part that I'm so passionate about fighting, that I might get lost at times trying to fight that so much that I don't communicate that, of course, the coach has a role. Of course we have a role. Obviously there would be no — I mean, just the fact that our jobs exist are evidence that there's a role. I mean, it's self-evident that coaches are necessary, because there would be no coaches if we weren't. But I think the level to which we have taken it currently in our development climate is not healthy. It's not healthy for athletes. It's not healthy for the parents of athletes. It's not healthy for overall development, because many coaches want to take over and they want to take control and they want to be front and center. So I think I'm passionate about fighting that because it's more rampant now than it ever has been, in my opinion. But yeah, the point that you made, Garrett, about obviously coaches need to be there to help be a guide, to help suggest ways to inform how athletes are interacting in their environment and adjusting their perceptions and attuning to the task better, feeling things that maybe they haven't felt before or challenging themselves in a way that they haven't been challenged before. Those are all necessary things for coaches to do. But I think it's also necessary for coaches to know their place at times and to get out of the way and not make it about themselves or their own ways of doing things being the most important thing. I don't know if that was super harsh. I don't know if, I mean, there will probably be some people that hear that are like, what? And I think that that's why, you know, I rub people the wrong way a lot of the time because I challenge those things. And the coaches who hear that and don't like it are the exact ones that I am challenging and the exact ones that I think are not very good for our game. So I guess that's kind of why it comes across that way and why I can rub some people the wrong way.
I think that's the hard part. one of the other challenges is, you know, because one of the other topics that got brought up was like, you know, flips and T work and doing all these more movement focused drills. And we do see that like players do have some success with those. Like, I think that's the hard thing for coaches is that if they weren't ever to see success, like nobody would do them, obviously. But because we do see some success, that's why coaches want to get in there and really tell the athlete like, hey, this is how you need to do things. If you want to be successful, this is how you have to do it. And it seems to work for some guys. And then it also doesn't work for a lot of other guys. And it wrecks the game for a lot of players. But I think that the real reason that people still do it is because we still see people having success. We still see people, you know, working with some of the best athletes, getting success, or, you know, it's touted in you know, different circles, people talking on social media, et cetera, that, oh yeah, this guy went over here and did a swing overhaul and he's moving like this now. And that's why, you know, we should focus on the mechanics versus focusing on helping guys to be able to move better, in relationship to the information in the environment, to be able to, more functionally be able to solve problems in the environment. But every, you know, the mechanical side of the people who will argue for mechanics is like, well, yeah, if I improve their mechanics, they're going to be able to do that. And so I think that's the biggest challenge is to figure out how to help people understand, because what we're talking about is such a completely 180, might even be more than a 180, you know, 360 to what how they're currently viewing, the problem or the issue, and how to work with players.
I would even ask the question like, and yeah, like I get those arguments all the time on a regular basis, like those exact things that you just said, Garrett, that, you know, oh, well, this guy does a lot of T work and he's good. This guy does this and he's good. This guy focused internally on his movements and did a lot of video and he's good. So obviously it works. I would even question like, are you taking like one facet of this guy's abilities and you are taking one facet of this guy's preparation and attributing that one piece to all of his success? Or maybe you're taking a couple things and saying, oh, because he does T work, this is why he's good. To me, that is a massive cognitive error in how we are evaluating, if this, then that. That is a, and the cognitive bias that exists, the description of that is escaping me right now. But to take one facet of somebody's preparation and saying, or one facet of a guy's model for how he goes about trying to get ready, and saying that that's why he's successful. I mean, because you could say, okay, well, he gets up in the morning and eats Fruit Loops every morning. So, okay, like if you get up in the morning, eat Fruit Loops every morning, then obviously you're going to be a great baseball player. Like, well, no, that's absurd. So how far are we going to take this? And obviously that's an extreme example, but,
well, and two, right. The player is saying that that was the big thing. Like, for example, since I follow the Twins, Max Kepler said that he had to get rid of a chain, and there was a cursed chain that he was wearing. And once he got rid of it, man, that was the thing that turned his hitting around. Right. So, I mean, right. Like that's kind of like what you're describing here.
And you hear things like that and you're like, no, it's not. That's absurd. Like, I mean, clearly there's a placebo effect that is going on there. And, you know, from a psyche standpoint, obviously that made a difference for him. But outside of that, which those types of things, I would argue, are a lot more within our control than we realize. We think that it's this like otherworldly, like the whole idea of a superstition, that it's like, well, if it's a superstition and if it works, then, you know, just keep doing it. Well, you're allowing yourself to be in that mindset. First and foremost, you allow yourself to enter the mindset that you have to have something happen a certain way or something can't happen a certain way. If you adjust your perspective and say, well, I don't have to have things go a certain way because I'm tougher mentally than that. And, my value and my level of success is attached to something greater than just whether I'm able to do this one activity or not. To me, that's a much healthier way to go about really anything in life. And that to me is a bigger life perspective and a bigger, more positive principle of life than just baseball, but that's another conversation. But I would argue, getting back to the, you know, these types of things that people attribute to their success, to take these like one or two things and say, well, this is why, and ignore many other factors and say, well, and just essentially assume that the rest of it's going to be there. Okay, so this guy does a lot of T work, and, you know, he focuses on his movements and does all this video work, and this is why he's good, and not factor in his intentions, not factor in his complete overhaul in, okay, now instead of trying to hit the ball on the ground, I'm trying to hit the ball in the air. His difference in understanding of where his production and where his value is going to come from. His adjustment from focusing on what a coach is telling him to do versus him taking autonomy over his own career. All those types of things that should factor into it. And we just say, oh no, he made this change to his swing and this is why he's good. That is, in my opinion, in no uncertain terms, is ignorance. And I understand that that is strong language, but to take this one factor or these two factors and say that this is why and ignore and just assume that everything else is going to be there, is missing large pieces of the puzzle. And which is why I am such a, I'm so much, and I know you're on the same page with me on this, Garrett, such a proponent of focusing on the system, the entire system, not taking one factor and saying, well, this is why, so do this, like 2 + 2 = 4. It's not an arithmetic problem. It's more like the quadratic equation. And there's all these different factors that go into it, that we need to consider and not just assume that they are going to be there if we do this one thing. And I think that that's probably one of my biggest issues with how we attempt to think about things right now in our development climate.
I think too that one of the things that I want people to understand, at least when the things that you describe, like even when I think about Max Kepler's chain, like from an ecological perspective, I can at least explain and understand why that might've helped them. So, because again, you know, I might sound a little bit like some of the people on Twitter, but at times you may have to be forced to adapt and utilize techniques that are less optimal, but they are optimal in the moment because the player that you're working with is not able to, fully utilize or appreciate, or what you would ideally want to use with him isn't going to be effective. And so being able to understand, like, for example, him changing the chain will now change his psychological state, which is a constraint on his system. And that change might be just simply having some sort of change. Like we've talked about this before, the Hawthorne effect, you know, simply changing something within your environment, giving a novel stimulus is going to help the athlete search for new information or be able to interact with the environment in a new and different way. And so just having a simple understanding of that. And I know like old school coaches have like understood that for forever and utilized, you know, the different little psychological games on their athletes to help them be successful. But that can only take you so far. Like that only works so many times. And so
that's to me, that's a Band-Aid. That's my opinion. Those are Band-Aids. And those are the types of things that I think, you know, the like almost to the point of being colloquial with how, you know, we traditionally have done that. Well, oh, it, in order to bust a slump, do this, or in order to bust a slump, make this change or do this. And yeah, it's like funny, but it's like, well, what if there's a better way? What if there's a way to where we don't need to do those things because we improve how we think about our success and our preparation, and we improve how we think about our entire system so much so that we don't need to rely on these gimmicky little things just to trick ourselves into, you know, another few days worth of success or a cue or like this magic bullet that works for a few days, and all of a sudden we got to find something else, and we jump to the next thing, and then we jump to the next thing. And to me, it's not a recipe for long-term success, but it's been accepted in baseball for so long that we just think that it's just the way that things have to be done. But what if we altered our perspective entirely on how we go about our entire process? Would we need to jump from one magical cue or one magical change to, from a superstition standpoint or a slump busting standpoint to the next? And I don't know the answer to that. These are the types of things that I wonder if we try to implement these things. And this goes back to really what you were saying really towards the beginning of the conversation, Garrett. Getting players to buy into that is going to be the biggest piece, because for so long we've had buy-in to the, you know, the whole slump busting, magic cue, jump from one thing to the next, like ride this for as long as you can and then find something else, and ride this for as long as you can and then change something else. We've relied on that process for so long. Getting guys to adjust their thinking entirely to not need that would be a massive, massive overhaul to how we go about things in our game. But I think it's at least worth asking the question whether it's a possibility or not.
I think too, more of where I was going was, or go ahead, Robert, if you want to jump in here.
Yeah, I wanted to say something real quick before we jump away from this, but it goes to basically in the statistical world where, let's say you have a regression model, and let's say, you know, your R squared's not what you want it to be. Now you're just shoving new variables in there to get it up. And I'll be like, oh, the R squared's at 0.7. It's a good model. All right, this means this. Basically, it's what it's saying is we're not like Caleb said, like Garrett said earlier, we're not trying to just shove things, you know, by saying, oh yeah, if we do this, hey, this will be magically better. If we do, you know, if we do that magic cue, oh, it'll be magically better. And then the age-old stats idea of correlation does not imply causation. And I think a lot of people miss out on that, because literally, like, just because, you know, let's say Mike Trout's doing T-work doesn't mean like that's the only reason why he's so successful is because he's doing T-work. It's a component thing. It's part of it. It's not the whole thing. Now, being able to quantify like how much of that's the tough part. But that doesn't mean, oh, hey, 100% of Mike Trout's success is because he's hitting off a tee.
Awesome. Yeah. Excellent point.
I also don't want to straw man the other side, because I don't think that's what they're arguing. I think what they're arguing is, well, they use it sometimes, therefore we should be able to use it sometimes. And I think the argument that we're making is that, yes, it can be useful, but, you know, it's like the Band-Aid. Like, it's not meant to stay on forever. And that's kind of more where I was going with what I was saying, is that the Band-Aid can be useful sometimes. Like, there's sometimes that you need to keep stuff out of a wound or whatever to help it heal. And so I think it's a useful tool sometimes, because you have to look at where the athlete is. You know, we always have to understand where we're currently are at and where we're trying to go to. And I agree with you, Caleb, that we're trying to go somewhere where we don't need to, you know, continually use that Band-Aid. But I think there's understanding the usefulness of novelty, understanding human psychology. These are techniques we may need to employ at times. And so I guess that's more what I would say to try to show a little bit of a middle road here. That's kind of at least how I'm seeing things, is that there's a usefulness, and it really comes down to your framework that you're using. What is the lens that you're looking through the world with, and how are you making assessments on when to utilize these things, and where you're trying to go with them? And that's why I'm a big proponent of an ecological approach. I've probably said that multiple times on this podcast, but that's really why, you know, I want to let people know about, is that this gives you a good framework to be able to navigate all these different things and have a good handle on why to use these things. I think the reason, because you brought up superstition, Caleb, you know, one of the reasons that we get superstitious is because we don't understand things. And when we don't understand things, we become afraid of them, and then we become very dogmatic and, I'm looking for what's the word? It's not violent, but, you know, we become very antagonistic towards others who like tend to break our sacred cows. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think having a framework that helps you be more flexible and adaptable, because that's one of the big things in ecological dynamics, is this idea of being adaptable and flexible and being able to adjust and all these sorts of things. And so that's where, you know, I feel like this framework allows me not to be, it's giving me an appreciation to understand, okay, well, I'm not big on using the tee or the machine, but there are certain instances with certain players where, okay, you know, I'll give a little bit here. I'll be flexible. I'll be adaptable. But it's everything that we're doing as coaches is right in service of the athlete and helping make the athlete better. But what we're saying on social media is that we're trying to nudge people away from these things that are less optimal for helping players be successful in the long run. Like, these things are, in essence, Band-Aids, like you're talking about, and we don't want to be wearing these things all the time.
Right. Yeah. So I agree with you. There is a pragmatism that has to take over if we want to create any level of momentum in helping to develop players. Pragmatism has to rule to a certain degree, especially when you're trying to build relationships, you're trying to build trust, you're trying to let athletes know that you care about them, that, you know, ultimately them as people matter more. And I think that's a good mix of working with them at times, getting feedback from them at times. But I think an added piece to this, to that pragmatism that doesn't get talked about much, is sort of seeing later on down the road that maybe what's best for their long-term development is for you helping them to understand that the things that maybe they want right now aren't necessarily the things that are going to be good for them long-term. I'll use the example of a personal trainer who, you know, has a client who's 100 pounds overweight that comes to them and says, "Hey, I want to lose 100 pounds. I have these goals from a fitness standpoint, from a physique standpoint." Maybe initially for the first few weeks when they give them their diet plan, maybe they, or their nutrition plan. I'm not a big fan of the word diet. When they give them their nutrition plan, they build in some flexibility for the first couple weeks, because they say, okay, you want to have a donut once or twice a week because you love donuts and that's going to help you stick with your plan, okay, go for it. But long term, over the amount of time that that personal trainer or that dietitian, nutritionist is working with that client, they would be doing them a disservice if they told them long term, okay, yeah, you can have your donut on a regular basis if you want to look like this. Or if you want to have these goals, like, yes, you still can do this. Like, no, that is not good for you long term. So it's building that trust up front. It's having a pragmatic approach up front. But it's, as we go through this process, I need to educate you that this is ultimately not what's good for you. This is not what's going to get you to a place where you can sustain this level of success that you want to be to. You said you want this. So because you want this, I need to be honest with you and upfront with you, and I need to be truthful that what you want is not necessarily what is good for you. And I think you can't, you know, going back to what we talked about earlier, you can't come in hot with that from the very beginning. But I think it's having a conversation and helping them understand through that relationship building and through that trust that, okay, these are the types of things that are probably not going to help you with the goals that you want. And to help them understand from an educational standpoint that it doesn't need to be part of their process and that there's a better way to go about things.
I think that's good. We've been going for a little bit here. So anything you guys want to wrap on? Robert, you got anything else you want to chime in on?
No, I think Caleb ended it beautifully.
Caleb, you want to leave people with anything?
I think I'm good.
Sounds good. Well, I hope this was helpful for people in kind of clarifying some of the stuff that, you know, we either say on social media or you say on social media and stirs people up, and hopefully we're able to, you know, address some of those things. But also people, you know, if you guys listen to this and have comments, feel free, throw them our way and we can hop on and discuss more. Cause I do feel like this is probably a better medium than, you know, social media, but social media is fun to get out little bite-sized clips that we can easily digest and kind of get the wheels turning. So, yeah, hopefully we can do more of these. Maybe next time too, Caleb. Maybe and Robert would maybe do like a live stream and have people ask questions and stuff.
Yeah,
that might be interesting. So if people actually want us to do that, you know, shoot us a comment, like it, you know, like, share, subscribe, all that social media jargon. But yeah, thanks guys for coming on and hopefully we can do it again soon.
Awesome. Thank you. Appreciate it.